Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. We're going to be focusing a lot again on the resource sector and more active investing in juniors and even some mid-tier stocks for all the investors that, unfortunately, we have been watching again a bit of a broad sell-off continuing for a lot of these stocks. Throughout the week, we did focus again on a lot of company updates because, look, there's still a lot of good news coming out of these companies, and it's a great time to be really reanalyzing the companies you're looking at and your portfolio for, hopefully, when some more interest comes back into the precious metal sector. I'm excited about these first two segments because we are introducing a relatively new guest on the show. We've had him on once before. His name is Dave Lotan. He is president of LHI, a family investment office, also pretty well known as being a large investor in the resource space. Dave, I want to start off with a little bit of your background and really what brought you into the commodity space, especially in terms of the junior space and some of the junior stocks. Let's start there, please.
Sure. Corey, thanks very much for having me on. So my background is in finance. I was a chartered accountant with Pricewaterhouse, which I guess is now PricewaterhouseCoopers. And for a bunch of random reasons, I was streamed into structured finance and derivatives, which were a bit of a hot topic during the late 1990s after the Orange County Pension Fund went bankrupt, and companies like Metal Gesellschaft, which was a commodities trading company out of Germany, had difficulties with futures and options contracts. And so there was a lot of focus on that at the board level, and auditing firms at the time were required to do a lot of work on the derivative portfolios of companies that were using these sort of levered products to hedge out risks that were not central to their business, that were commodity related and were embedded in their commercial activities. So I worked with some of the Canadian banks that were using swaps and interest rate options to hedge off the mismatch between their liabilities and their assets. And I worked with some of the oil refineries in Canada that were using futures and options to hedge off the difference between their cost of crude and their eventual proceeds from the sale of natural gas and heating oil and that sort of thing. And I got hired away by a hedge fund called Polar Capital, which was running a small mortgage bank in Canada that was in some difficulty. It was sourcing most of its money from the capital markets and using derivatives to hedge off mismatches. And so I did get a little bit lucky. We turned that business around and it got sold. And I then started a business in partnership with them, which was involved in other leveraged opportunities in Canadian credit markets. I sold that business to one of the big Canadian banks in 2007 and briefly retired, but then went over to one of the big pension funds with the ostensible task of building a similar business, but much larger in size. And shortly after that, the mortgage crisis began in the United States. Actually, it started in Canada. We had a bunch of asset-backed commercial paper that froze and couldn't be rolled here. And it became obvious that these structured finance techniques, these leverage techniques, were not going to work anymore. So I hung around that pension fund doing some distressed opportunities until 2008, and then decided that I couldn't run my own money and run their money at the same time. So I retired and focused for a while on banks, U.S. banks and insurance companies, which were the distressed opportunity of the day. I really owned a small amount of exposure in gold and commodities at the time. That trade played out over a couple of years, and I eventually liquidated that portfolio. And then I walked right into what looked like a fantastic opportunity in Canadian juniors in about November of 2011, which, as you will both note, was about 4 years too early. So I spent quite some time thinking about all of the mistakes that I was making and adding to them, deconstructing this business. And when it was almost too late, I decided it was a fantastic contrarian opportunity, and have since 2015 spent most of my time in commodity related juniors. I think that's why we're here today.
Well, Dave, after your traditional background in financing and managing pension funds and being involved with that side of the equation, what mental shift did you go through that caused you to take a deeper dive in the commodity sector? Why did you decide that gold, silver, phosphates, base metals were the place to start looking for unseen opportunity?
Sure. Well, my investing framework, I would say, is based on three things, really. The first and most important thing to think about in making any investment decision is who's going to buy it from you. And it follows from that, you might be interested in who's selling it to you. And I would put that under the broader umbrella of flow. And I think that one of the things that I recognized too late was that by 2014, it became obvious that flows into Canadian stocks and especially Canadian resource-based stocks were completely negative and would be negative for quite some time. And that was because of the structure of the industry. Many of these companies were financed by sector-specific mutual funds in Canada, which had very high management expense ratios, very high management fees. And the whole world was moving over to ETFs. And as you both know, when, for instance, a precious metals fund begins to produce negative returns, it experiences redemptions, there's a massive mismatch between the, you know, daily liquidity that these funds offer their unit holders and the amount of time it takes for a mining project to come on stream. So there were massive structural mismatches in the way the business was being funded, which resulted in what I thought would be negative flows for quite some time. So flow was important to me. And psychology was important to me, and just the whole concept of entropy. And that's, you know, systems are always breaking down and being reorganized as new systems. And I guess in the world of commodities, sort of the apex example of that was the gold standard breaking down in 1971 and Nixon taking the U.S., closing the gold window in the United States. And that led to the first time in history when there was no hard money in the global system, and led to some spectacular opportunities in commodities as a result of that during the 1970s. So that framework in my mind has been active ever since 1971. There was a long gold bear market after Volcker got in at the Fed and did some of the best work I've ever seen a central banker do, or I've ever, I suppose, read about a central banker doing. Inevitably, things began to go in a different direction. So from the 40,000-foot view, I've always believed that gold was going to go into a 1,000-year bull market after 1971. And, you know, maybe we don't have 1,000 years left on Earth. But unfortunately, it can go into bear markets that last for years. And it should be a cautionary tale for all of us that we had a 20-year bear market from 1981 or 82 to 2001, 2002, depending on when you think it peaked and when you think it bottomed. Within all of that, and assuming that you believe in that view, the sector itself has its own cycles within these large cycles. And I think it's fascinating that Barrick as a company was effectively built in the 1980s, just as gold was going into this great and historic bear market counter move to what I thought would be a very long bull market. So when you think about Arequipa being sold for $30 a share on the strength of Purina in 1996. Or when you think about Diamond Fields being sold for $4 billion in 97, or was it 96, during a year when nickel averaged $3.20 a pound. If you really, really take this sector apart, there are opportunities, big picture opportunities, and then there are many counter cycles and mini cycles within larger cycles.
Dave, let's get into some of the company specific stuff, because honestly, that's what a lot of people always want to hear. What's Dave buying? What is a big shareholder like yourself? What do you even look for in a company right now when, in all fairness, I think you need to be selective in this market?
So I think I've gone over 10% on three companies and gone in public domain on Fox River, which is a phosphate play in Northern Ontario, and Orion, which is a gold exploration company in Finland, and on CBG or Chibougamau Independent Mines, which had a bunch of old copper mines in the Chibougamau camp in Quebec. And so first and foremost, I want to buy into an ethical management team. And in general, where I've gone over 10% or where I've joined a board, it's because I think management is ethical. That if those conditions are not there, then it doesn't preclude me from making an investment, but it certainly informs the size of investment that I'm willing to make. And I wouldn't go in public domain if I didn't think management was trustworthy. There are lots of management teams out there that I think are highly conflicted, where I will still invest, but to get to that kind of size, I have to think that the people running the company have good intentions. And Orion was a great example. Mike and I had worked together for many years. He was an ethical guy. He wanted to make discoveries. There was a part of his business that he wasn't great at. That was awareness and promotion. But he was phenomenal at assembling property packages, and he was a great steward of investor capital. So I went over 10% and later joined the board to help him with the things that he didn't have the time to focus on or wasn't experienced at. With CBG, we're talking about copper assets. When I started my position in that company, I think I was able to buy about 9.9% of it at, let's say, a sub $2 million valuation. And we've seen these old brownfield camps in Quebec get reinvigorated, in the Abitibi, get reinvigorated on a regular basis. Red Lake was dead until Gold Eagle made a new discovery underneath the Bruce Channel at Cochenour. And from out of nowhere, I think it was called Southern Star Resources and one of Steve Roman's old companies came together. And a couple of years later, the whole thing got sold to Goldcorp for $1.5 billion. And there had been no developments in Red Lake since the discovery of the high-grade zone in the 1990s. And all of a sudden, this camp was producing, with no resource and only a few years worth of history, $1.5 billion acquisition. So when I thought about the Chibougamau camp and I thought about how fragmented it had been for most of its existence, I think it had 16 headframes in it at one point, and had been brought together briefly under Patino Mines. All of this came to an end when copper hit 50 cents in the 1990s, but really was out of business and in one crappy junior and mostly in bankruptcy during the next 20 or so years. I thought about this as a camp that could be the next Malartic potentially, or I suppose, well, the next Red Lake is a bit of a stretch. It's a copper gold camp, but it didn't even need to be those things. What it needed was to be a camp that had a lot more ore to give, where if it were united, and if it wasn't a camp that was the subject of premature production ambitions, if it was properly explored, you might have something like a Malartic outcome. And I think both of you know the history of Malartic and that it was a little high grade. It was a bunch of high grade underground mines that eventually was united by Osisko and turned into, and then they found the deeper porphyry underneath, and and turned it into a 500,000 ounce a year producer. But it took time, and it took consolidation, and it took years. And so CBG was, in my mind, that kind of an opportunity. And given the valuation that you're able to buy it at, which was sub $2 million at the time, you didn't even need it to have the market upside. And you know, it's moved in fits and starts since then, but it's obviously much more valuable than when I assembled my initial stake.
Well, Dave, there's about 1,000 interviews that I think all of us have heard where we ask people, you know, why do you pick the companies you pick and what gets your interest? And we hear team, we hear project, we hear jurisdiction, we hear capital. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, there's 1,000 different junior mining companies. So I'm curious, you know, when you peel back the layers, other than the normal talking points we always hear, what are you really looking for in a project? Is it the stage they're at, like an exploration stage or development stage? Mm-hmm. Is it an area mm-hmm. play? Or is there something else that you see? Because you've also had a history of uniting different projects and bringing together different teams, different assets, and forming better arrangements, or at least as an investor, seeing those things happening before others. So what's the real mm-hmm. value proposition that Dave Lotan looks at when you're analyzing mining stocks?
It's a very hard question to answer. And I'll tackle it, start with this way. So I'm sure you both remember Nevsun. And Nevsun in the early 2000s at one point was a 12-cent stock. And Bisha wasn't even in the company at that point in time. It was never consolidated. Bisha eventually came. It turned into some spectacular high-grade results, although in BMS and in a district that was very difficult to deal with. But the cycle came around, and the company was able to get project financing and get it into production. It might have peaked at $13 at one point before they ended up taking over Reservoir Capital for Timok, and then getting taken over themselves by, I think, I can't remember the name of the Chinese company that took it over. So this isn't an answer anyone will like, but when you're buying companies run by decent people that are cheap enough, and you're buying them at the bottom of the cycle, sometimes you just have to have the faith that what's going to be valuable is coming, even if it isn't there yet. My original stake in Orion started when the company wasn't in Finland. I think I got to 5% when Mike was just grinding his axe in Mexico. And I met him at the airport on the trip that when he came back having been through a nightmare, having been held at gunpoint, having discovered a body on the property while touring Kinross at the time, who ceased to be even aware of the company for years until they came back into our Finland business. And we sat at the airport and talked about how the company was just going to have to write off its investment in Mexico and take the capital that it had and move on and look for other things. And so, as I said, it's not the answer that anyone wants to hear, but when you're in a sort of a massive counter-cyclical trade, especially in juniors, you have faith in the process in Vancouver and in Canada, where these companies go to zero. If they have money, they're able to buy assets very cheaply. That may revalue as the cycle turns. And if they don't, they may do an RTO or be combined to become part of something bigger, as happened with Ryan Gold and Corona Gold and Oban, which were all cash shells that I think off air we discussed the fact that I owned 7 or 9% of each one of them. They had cash. The sector didn't have cash. They combined with Eagle Hill and they became Osisko Mining. So sometimes if you're at that point in the cycle where cash is king and no one has cash, you might just buy cash at a discount. If the people managing the company are in your mind ethical and well-intentioned, you might buy cash for cash or some slight premium. Sometimes, as in the case of CBG, you're buying assets that trade for nothing, understanding that similar assets have been dramatically revalued in turning cycles. And sometimes you're buying leveraged opportunities. And I guess Claude Resources would be a fantastic example of that. I mean, the CB deposit, I think, had a lot of potential. Often, in the, you know, Richmont would be another great example, or Westome. These were just really, really rusty old underground operations that didn't make any money, that were just clattering along, getting by during a low commodity price environment. They had just enough debt to go bankrupt, and they all had discoveries in existing underground mines. And if you had the courage to go into those companies at the bottom of the cycle, you got the revaluation of their earning streams, and you got these fabulous high-grade discoveries, which convert into a lot of market cap very quickly. And of course, I guess Kirkland Lake would be a great example of that. But in theory, Kirkland Lake was never really in distress.
All right, Dave, we're going to wrap it up there. Really interesting comments. And I really like that look back in history and seeing how some of these now well-known companies have developed and grown and what it took to get them just a higher market cap and a project that really captured the attention of investors. We're going to have you back on the show again, Dave, because you do have some great insights in the market and, again, a very active investor in the space. So, Dave, appreciate your time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we will chat again soon.
Many thanks for having me, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.